it's kind of like getting dressed for a wedding and having your boutonniere fixed up and everything. Well, greetings, everyone. Nice to see you. I hope things work out well here. Certainly been a nice feast. We've enjoyed ourselves and enjoyed meeting all you. Appreciate that fine music we were able to enjoy here together. I just can't understand how that can be done. I can't sing at all. But seeing these people come together from different countries and different church areas that have never seen one another before, and the ability to put together this song service and have it sound so nice is really wonderful. I'm sure it takes a lot of effort ahead of time and the coordination and leadership of it, and we certainly appreciate it. Certainly appreciate the nice hall we're able to meet in here as well. If I don't put this down a little bit, I'm going to be afraid to look at my notes. So we've been having a good time. I hope you have too. I'm sure you have. It's great to be here in Estonia for the feast. My wife Diane and I certainly enjoyed a little bit of travel a little bit before the feast began, and in Tallinn, and we saw the old city. It was really a nice time to take a walk around there. And you know, I was thinking, we were talking about the future and gold and so forth. Somehow we went to see a couple of these jewelry stores that had all of the amber, and you walk in a store and the whole room glitters, glows like it was gold. Now I know it's not worth that much comparatively, but as diamonds and emeralds and so forth go, but it certainly is a nice environment, a nice taste, and we appreciated seeing some of those things. And then we, of course, when we went to the spa, we had to have a massage that Victor highly recommended, and then we made the reservation, paid the money, we're ready to go, and bumped into him, and he started giggling. And he says, "You tell me about it afterwards." And here you, I don't know how many of you had it, but you go there and they have this little mini bikini you have to wear. I was embarrassed to come out from behind the curtain. Aside from that, it's been a really nice time. Well, it is a beautiful country, and we enjoy the feast here. So, we're here to worship God, of course, enjoy the fellowship that He's provided from those children that He's called together to be together and learn more and more how we can properly fear Him. We've heard that mentioned from time to time. We can learn of His accomplishments, His plan, His purpose, His creation, His calling of each of us out of this world and into His kingdom. And these are things we need to focus on and do focus on during the feast. So we're here to worship Him and learn those things. Part of the creation we live in, this earth, is fabulous. And I say part because the earth is such a little teeny tiny piece of the total creation as we start to look at it. And so is every aspect of the universe, absolutely fabulous. In the last couple of centuries in particular, and especially the last few decades, there's been a great deal of scientific information studied and learned about creation. And the degree of understanding was simply not available to mankind until these recent times because of the instruments that we, as man, have developed, telescope in particular. And, of course, the one which has such great notoriety these days, the Hubble telescope that's out orbiting around the Earth and sending back such fabulous pictures. By the way, we can get on. I'm sure you can, too, if you've got computer and web access to the NASA website, and you get downloads there of the fabulous pictures that the Hubble is being used to develop and send back to us. And it's just a great thing to do once in a while to just go into the program and do that. I'd like to turn to Deuteronomy chapter 14. It's been the sorts of things we talk about at feasts all the time. I don't mean to belabor this per se, but I do want to read in Deuteronomy 14 and verse 22 and 23. "You shall surely tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year, and that you send, or you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where He chooses to make His name abide, the tithe of your grain and your new wine and your oil of the firstlings of your herds and your flocks." And we always read about that in terms of tithing, especially on the first day and the last great day and so forth. But the point I wanted to point out is that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. So we put away this cost of doing these wonderful trips like this and getting together with one another, and we spend that time to kind of exemplify the way things will be in the world tomorrow. Once we get past those times that Mr. Schreiber was talking about and Mr. Kubik were talking about, of the difficult, tremendous, horrendous times where we are going to begin to rebuild this earth. Ultimately, it'll fulfill all of our wildest dreams about how wonderful it will be. And so we're using the second tithe to come together for that reason, which is that you learn to fear the Lord your God. Fear. Fear in the sense of not quaking and shaking because we know He's going to do something terrible to us, but in the sense of standing in awe and wonder about how great and wonderful and powerful God is. And because of that, to come to worship Him. Worship Him in the right frame of mind and attitude. And we can do so in part by learning more about His creation. I've read quite a few books that delve into many of the scientific factors that we know about in this modern world today. They really do speak in detail about the massive, huge aspects of the cosmos and on down through submicroscopic, subatomic bits and pieces and particles and forces that constitute the material of our existence. Now, there's been some difficult reading along some of these times. My wife thinks I'm nuts, but, you know, I read these things about the awesome universe and about Einstein's theory of relativity and the thing beyond that, which is called string theory, which takes his intent and purpose and his development of the formula everyone is so enamored by and knowledgeable about, and takes it a next step or two, trying to get further and deeper into the details of what God has created and understand them. How did this entire universe come to be formed? Now, we know God did it, but we're always looking at the mechanics of how He used to do it. Now, from the scientific point of view, it's probably always looking at it from the standpoint of disproving God, for the most part. Although I've read several things of scientists that really have come to believe God because of the awesome things they discover in a scientific sense. But you try to delve into those things and they are just astonishing in their detail and their perfection and their dependability, that only a mind of God could put these factors together. So today I wanted to expound on some of the technical details that in and of themselves only help us to understand how great and powerful God is. I don't expect you to become physicists because of it, but I think it helps to put in context the kinds of things we're learning and looking towards in our lives. There are so many aspects of God and His accomplishments that it's difficult to only talk to one, and even that in the available time, although there's more than what I typically will have in a split sermon, but I hope that I come out pretty well even. I was afraid I might be a little short even. But I must do what I can do in this time for this kind of a subject. And I'll just cover some of the highlights and hopefully put these in context with the feast messages. So I'm going to address this in four parts. Part one, I've called Some of the Amazing General Physical Aspects of the Universe God Created. I'm sorry, Robert. He's translating. Part one, anyway. One of the amazing things that we can see every day, night, is more like what I'm referring to that we can see every day, is the beautiful starry canopy overhead. Well, let's turn to Psalms 147, and we'll see a little bit of what we're told in the Bible. In Psalm 147, and verse 4 and 5, we'll read, "He counts the number of the stars. He calls them all by name. Great is our Lord and mighty in power. His understanding is infinite." And of course, this goes on and on, and it's very beneficial to read all about the things that God tells us about His creation. But He counts or tells us the number of the stars. He's even got names for the stars. Wow, you know, impossible task for us to even believe. This is bigger numbers than even those in Zimbabwe who are trying to figure out how to count their money. that Mandy's telling us about. Those trillions and trillions of, I don't know what the unit values are in their monetary bills, but it's just an awesome thing. When we think about those kinds of statements from God in Psalms here about the stars, we should all take a deep breath and contemplate just what that really is indicating for us. And certainly many have done that before. People throughout history, throughout this world that didn't have energy to have light, didn't have the invention of electric lights and so forth, they would sit out in their campgrounds, their homes, their fields, and look up and see the fabulous beauty of the nighttime that God shows us, of all the stars, the suns, that we're privileged to see and appreciate. We see that big Milky Way band across the sky where there's millions and millions, hundreds of millions of stars, and it kind of a, looks like a concentration in the sky where we might think perhaps the universe is totally uniform, but this is just looking across the edge of our galaxy. Just one galaxy out of hundreds of billions of galaxies. So we can, I think, have a little touchstone way back to the beginning of man's existence by looking up and seeing those kinds of things in the heavens and know our God, our great God, that we're privileged to worship, He created all that. The sky is beautiful. It's awesome in scope and detail and power and dependability. And we look out and see those higher densities and we call it the Milky Way and we think that's beautiful and we stumble along our way, not thinking too much about how vast a universe there is out there. Milky Way, our galaxy, is called the Milky Way galaxy. It's kind of shaped like a fried egg, and we're two-thirds of the way out of the towards the edge, and we're looking back across the entire diameter of it. There's a book titled Understanding the Universe that provides some astonishing facts about the universe that we live in. We look at it as up in a quiet and peaceful beauty, and we hardly think about how huge it really is. Now, it's been mentioned a little bit. I think Mr. Kubik mentioned 100 billion and so forth. This book does point out there that there are at least 100 billion galaxies, just as this observable one is that we're part of. And I read recently that we don't know how big it is. That's only an estimate based on what we can see, even with the best of telescopes. We only see part way out to wherever the end of it is, if there is an end. That's only a part of it. And yet, 100 billion galaxies. Now, we've had telescopes, continuously improved telescopes, for hundreds of years, and with the most effective being the Hubble. And so that gives us a great deal of insight as modern man to be able to see more, think more, plan more, analyze more, try to understand more about what God has done. And even with that, we don't know what's out there completely. Another amazing fact is that our little galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, is comprised of about 100 billion stars itself. So 100 billion galaxies, 100 billion each, those numbers get enormous when you think about how many stars and then multiple planets, undoubtedly, circling around each of those. We count 9 on our solar system. Some of our moons have 32 planets around the planet. Just awesome number of little bits and pieces around the universe. Too many for us to really contemplate. So with 100 billion galaxies and each with 100 billion stars or suns, ours is just one of those. And of course there are far greater number of planets and moons and asteroids and comets and other astral things. I don't want to overwhelm you or bore you with these kinds of numbers or figures, so I'll limit the section. But a few facts I think are very expressive. We're 26,000 light years from the center of our own galaxy. And that's, I say, a half or two-thirds of the way out from the center. And we're on the edge of one of those spiral arms. You know, Mr. Schreiber showed one picture there with this great big spiral. It looks like a starfish doing the hula or something. It's just enormous and awesome and beautiful to see. And it's so big. But nevertheless, it's tiny in comparison to the closest galaxy, and that's our Andromeda galaxy, and that's 2 million light years away. One little flash of light takes 2 million years to get to where that other galaxy is, and that's the close one. Just mind-boggling. So that's just one of 100 billion galaxies, and it's the closest. The book estimates that on average, each galaxy produces one new star every year. Other estimates are 2 stars per year. Doesn't sound like too many when you say 1 or 2, but then you throw in that 100 billion, and there could be 200 billion new stars created every year. Stars like our sun. How could we relate to that? Well, I got it figured out. In this about 30 minutes worth of sermon time, just during this time, there will be over 1.5 million stars born. Isn't that astonishing? And God makes them. God knows them, names them, numbers them. Our God has an unlimited amount of capability and capacity in mind. And yet he called you and me to be a part of his family. And that's absolutely astonishing. Well, this kind of information just, you know, goes on and on and on. So you can see why the title of the sermon that I selected was How Great and Powerful Our God Is to Be Able to Do These Things. And we're privileged to know about them. Let's turn to Job. Job got lost here. Where did Job go? There he is. Between fighting with where the microphone is and where my Bible has to be and where my notes are, bear with me. Job chapter 38, because we know God talks to Job about some of the things that put Job in his place, if you will, let him really understand what he was and how he fit into the scheme of things a little better. So in Job 38 and verse 3 and 4, we read, "Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have an understanding." You know, here's all these stars just orbiting around in nothing. What holds them together? Why do the planets go around a sun and not fall in or fall out or come apart? Well, God made it so these things function. And so he's asking, plain little man, like Job was a wonderful guy, and he's probably the most capable and qualified and accomplished that we know of, but yet God knew he needed one facet more of polishing of his stone to be a jewel in the family. But he says, stand up like a man and tell me, where were you when I figured out how to do this? Well, it kind of puts you in your place, doesn't it? I certainly think so. In verse 6, he says, to what were its foundations fastened? In verse 31, can you bind the cluster of the Pleiades or loose the belt of Orion? Can you bring the Maseroth in its season? Well, these are constellations we all still see now, just like they saw from the beginning of man's creation. The belt of Orion. Most everybody can pick out the Orion constellation. You know, it's a belt and a sword and so forth. Who did that? Job couldn't possibly do that or answer that or know how it happened or functioned. But God put it there. He uses the constellations for guidance of seasons for ancient mankind. So we can tell by the constellations what season it is. We can tell by where the constellations are in Polaris, the North Star, how to navigate on the oceans of the world without having super high-tech tweets and Twitters and all those gizmos that Victor plays with. In fact, I didn't know you were under the table last night with that woman. But God has done these things. He's put these things together, and he, you know, in Scripture, he asked these points, of course, of Job, so that we can begin to get a little bit more understanding of what this is all about. And he was the most righteous man of all times. His friends didn't tell him. They didn't know, but God knew what Job needed to know. So he asked him these things about creation and how these fabulous things were done, so that Job could finally come to realize what a vast difference there was between he and God. And that's a great lesson for us to know. We really do need to know that. We can sometimes neglect the degree of detail and perfection that God has provided in this universe, and that we're privileged to be a part of and privileged to know about. And I think we're learning more in this modern time than mankind in the past has learned in that sense, and we should become to a greater, deeper understanding of what God has done, even compared with our predecessors. So it's a massive way of showing what God is like and putting things into the universe in a size scale. God asks, can you do these things? What if he asks you, can you do these things? Can you do them? Well, absolutely no way. We so often man thinks they're natural phenomena. They just happen. They're just accidentally there. But they're not. They're there on purpose. So that just points a few of the things in a list to come to appreciate how God is and what he does. I was going to turn here to Matthew. Was in my notes, and again, sorry, Robert, in Matthew 5, verse 14. Matthew 5, and verse 14 to 16. You are the light of the world. The city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. So let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. So here's a modern day version of perhaps what God was telling Job, that our light should shine, and we can come to understand more about light by study of physics, study of things in the cosmos, to realize how vast it is, and how tiny a light way out there we can come to see and appreciate, and realize that some of those things we see out there are not just a sun, as great as that is, but an entire galaxy of 100 billion suns, and is visible over the entire universe. And he's likening that kind of light to the light that's in you and me. We're supposed to be a light so that all the other billions of men and women throughout man's history can see. They can see God in us through the light that we shed in how we conduct our lives and helping him in the work that's being done, and show to the world around us just how great our God is. In part two, God tells us he created all things. Let's go to Colossians 1. Colossians 1 and verse 15. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers. All things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things consist. And he is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he may have preeminence. That's Jesus Christ. The context shows this, of course, and we read it and read the words, so we come to know more about God, more about Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ was the creator of God before the Big Bang. And they talk about the Big Bang being on the order of 14 billion years ago. Well, you know, I haven't read it anywhere, but by logic I look at it and think, the Big Bang didn't just happen. God and the Word of the Old Testament, who became Jesus Christ, together prior to that time, had to dream it up. They had to think about it. They had to want to do it. They had to prepare for it. And then he had Jesus Christ, or the Word at that time, carry out that creation, the hands-on aspect, if you will. An awesome thing that our Jesus Christ did. Created everything that is. And you count back 14 billion years, something we can't really comprehend. Awesomely long time. And the earth is something like, they say, 3, 4, 5 billion years of age. And then he came and he created. He had to have done this. I mean, again, I haven't read this, but he had to have created the original land filled with vegetation and dinosaurs and woolly mammoths and all those things we dig up now in archaeology projects and find that they existed long ago. And then they were destroyed. Well, I can see pictures in one of these books that I read from the scientific world of those animals having food in their mouths that had been in the process of being eaten, hadn't been digested, hadn't been rotted. And when they dug up some of the woolly mammoths that said that the people that were kind of trying to get them out of the ground, you know, knocked some flesh loose and they threw it to the dogs and the dogs ate it, it was edible after several billion years. And it lay dormant. And then we read in Genesis 1 that we're so familiar with, of God restoring all that vegetation, all those fish and all those birds and all those animals and mankind. So this has been a big project. I'm a project manager from way back. Nothing like this. I try to go get a building built somewhere, you know, and you got enough problems there to drive you nuts. And I can just begin to scratch the surface of seeing how enormous a task and this has been. And then we look forward to the things we're supposed to be doing now in the new world to come before us, and we're going to try to restore and improve whatever is destroyed by the time we get to that point. Huge project. Enormous challenges. But God called us to do it. God knows we can do it. With His help, obviously. So all things were created by Him, seen and unseen. So we haven't even talked about the unseen. These are just things you see. So there's an awful lot that we need to come to learn to appreciate about God, to fear God in the proper way and attitude. So Colossians tells us a little bit about that, that He's the head of the church, and that's spiritual, so that's one of those unseen things, and we're part of that church, the firstborn, that He'll be bringing with Him when he comes back to this earth. And we're going to be like Him. Let's turn over to Hebrews chapter 1 for a moment. Hebrews 1 and verse 1. God, who at various times and in different ways spoke in times past to the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by His Son, whom He has appointed heir of all things, through whom He also made the worlds. So yes, we have a lot in the Bible about the prophets and what they said about things in this world in times past. But we see here now He's spoken to us by His Son, human being, just like we. Of course, He died. He's changed to spirit being once again. But He knows us. He knows our way of thinking. He knows our needs. And He created everything, all things, it says here, all things. That's the universe and beyond. The Moffat translation actually shows the word as universe, whereas most of our translations don't say that. Throughout the book of Hebrews, there are several references to Him and what we're to inherit. Along with Him, we're going to inherit all things, inherit the universe as a responsibility. Now, we don't know really what that all entails yet, obviously. But He's the head of the church, and we're part of it, and what He inherits, we're going to inherit. So this even looks beyond the world that we're going to have to rebuild. It looks beyond that by a long, long stretch. As I say, Mr. Kubik and Mr. Schreiber showed some of that, but that's just the world. What happens to those hundreds and hundreds of billions of suns and all the planets that whirl around them? Is that what we're going to have something to do with in the far distant future, after the 1,000 years? Or are we going to sit there on a cloud and stare at Jesus Christ and think, wow, what a wonderful ride we had? I don't think that's going to cut it for eternity. I think we're going to have some major other responsibilities that we don't even have the capacity to begin to envision and understand at this point. That's a wonderful future out there for us when we begin to think about that. Let's turn to Isaiah chapter 40. Isaiah Isaiah 40 and verse 12. And it says here, who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, measured the heaven with a span, and calculated the dust of the earth in a measure, weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or his counselor has taught him? With whom did he take counsel, and who instructed him and taught him in the path of justice? Who taught him knowledge and showed him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are as a drop in the bucket, and are counted in small dust on the balance. Look, he lifts up the isles as a very little thing. Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor is its beef sufficient for an offering. All nations before him are as nothing. They are counted by him less than nothing and worthless. Well, that puts him in an extremely exalted position to think of these things that we think are so wonderful. I mean, we look around the country we're touring. It's beautiful. Beautiful things out there that God made. And he counts these as nothing. And they probably are relatively nothing because of the greatness and the awesomeness that the future holds for all of us. And yet, he's the one that brought these things in together, brought them to us. They're awesome concepts. Even these things of the earth, that who measured the waters, who calculated the dust. How many little particles of dust are there? We think God can't count them? I mean, he's got more suns out there in the universe than dust particles here, so it's not really a challenge. Well, he can even count the hairs of... Well, it's easier now. But he has to keep track of the ones who are gone, besides the ones that are left. So it talks here about God's Holy Spirit and its influence on knowledge and counsel and justice and understanding. And note that everything is not a problem for God to take care of. Shows his greatness in every way. Let's skip over here a little bit to Psalm 8 and verse 1. Psalms 8 and verse 1. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth, you who set up your glory above the heavens. In verse 3, it says, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you ordained, what is man that you're mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? For you have made him a little lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor. You have made him to have dominion over all the world, all the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, even the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, the fish of the sea that pass through the paths of the seas. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth. Our God has made all these things. He's brought them all together. He's teaching us about them and put them in our dominion, if you will. It's just an awesome thing that he cares enough about you and me that he would use his vast resources and capabilities of accomplishment and knowledge and understanding and detail and so forth, his power, and let us learn from these and have responsibility for these things. It's just not fully developed yet about what it will be that we'll be dealing with, but it's only a beginning in earnest, a down payment of having put his Spirit in us, and he's entrusted us with the same power by which he created these 100 billion galaxies with 100 billion suns each. He's given us that responsibility. We can't exercise it yet, but he's given it to us, and in some way we're going to deal with it. That's what God has begun in us. That's what he's placed in us. You can't earn that. It's a free gift from God. Part 3, modern physics understanding of the creation. I don't have any scriptures in this section. I just wanted to make mention of a couple things. I want to cover to some extent the scientific writings I read in a book called Case for a Creator. I extracted some of the amazing details. And physics can get very complicated very quickly. Many, many, many parameters that can be studied about the makeup of the universe and our Earth. And one of those is that there's a huge range of forces that are part and parcel of the structure. There are four types of forces, basically, that exist in the universe. You're very familiar with one, and that's gravity. Another is the force in atoms, which is called the strong force. There's also something called the weak force. And so these kinds of forces are what are balanced one way or another in the way God has arranged things to function. And I don't expect you to fully understand. I don't fully understand the technical aspects of all these kinds of things, but just wanted to consider the overwhelming concepts that are pointed out. The difference in strengths is that the nuclear force is 10,000 billion, 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 billion times stronger than gravity. That's a lot of zeros behind that little period in American and coma, perhaps in your numbering system. That many billion times stronger than gravity is 10 followed by 39 zeros. Now, if you had a big ruler marked off in centimeters, which is impossible, obviously, with centimeters that represented that range, it would be billions upon billions upon billions of centimeters long. And if you could set a dial of some sort in your creation, move it 1 centimeter, just 1 centimeter out of billions, life as we know it would not exist. The precarious, perfect arrangement that God has provided is that control which provides for life. It could fall off either side of that scale, and the material of the universe wouldn't clump into clusters, or it wouldn't form at all. It would be dust clouds in some fashion, or it's just mind-boggling that such a small, tiny control adjustment would make that difference. So the universe wouldn't exist. Stars that we think of wouldn't have lifetimes or permanent in any way. Our sun's life is expected to be 10 billion years long. Couldn't exist. So that's just one of the measures that are pointed out here. It's a measure. There's another one. It's called the energy density of empty space. It's the accumulation of all the radiation and light and energy and gravitational pulls from the stars and the other astral bodies and light from other forms of radiation. It's called the cosmological constant. It's one physical factor that the physicists use a lot in their calculations. It was part and parcel of what Einstein built into his general relativity theory. And if this factor were not extremely precise, exactly what it is, the stars wouldn't, again, clump. They wouldn't form together. The universe would collapse. And the accuracy of the fine-tuning of these factors is 10 by followed by 53 zeros. Inconceivably precise. And that's only one or two of the factors that are so precise. There are over 30 that the physicists have identified. And the accuracy of things has to include them all for things to function the way they are. It's absolutely impossible that the Earth, the atmosphere the way it is, gravity the way it is, life could exist without these factors being absolutely perfect. No humans, no animals, no atmosphere, no rain clouds, nothing. Probably not even on Earth. That God is the one we worship, that built those things so precisely that we can have life and learn to fear God. So what's it mean to us? Well, Jesus focused his mind and his heart and his life on the continuation of what's described as the Church of the Firstborn. And, you know, we're looking towards the end of the age. 144,000 is talked a lot about in Revelation and the great multitude. Jesus came here to give us knowledge, to give us understanding, to give us the opportunity to learn these kinds of things, learn how to be servant leaders in our respective spheres of influence, learn to put the kinds of things into practice that we can come to appreciate from him. And that's what it is to serve God. Because of serving God, then we'll be written into the book of remembrance that he talks about in Malachi 3. We're not going to turn there. Time is gone. But God has designed you and me. He's designed us to have a much greater effect and influence and use in His family and in His universe than just being, as great as this is, as just being members of His church in this life. He has far greater plans for us. And He's a God that has shown through all of His creation and all these factors that we've talked a little bit about that He has the capacity to do that. And He's given Jesus Christ the job to see that we aren't lost. We're going to do the job that He has for us. He's going to assure it. And if we do something wrong, if we stumble here and there, He's going to pick us up, straighten us out, dust us off, and say, now you go do this, learn that lesson. And if we falter somewhere along the way, He's going to pick us up again and say, okay, go over here and get that lesson. He's going to make sure that we're concluded in being perfected as being part of His family and His sons and daughters forever. Well, I hope that this helps you appreciate our God, partly to come to learn to fear Him, and I hope you have a wonderful last great day tomorrow.